From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Butte County, California is expecting rain, which firefighters welcome, but there's concern about mudslides and the impact on the search for human remains. Around 700 people are still unaccounted for. Chris Blair, a retired firefighter, a battalion chief, has been volunteering with the Santa Barbara County Search and Rescue Team up in Paradise. He's now back in Santa Barbara. Chris, not easy, sleeping with hundreds of volunteers in a nearby high school, then sifting through ash in Paradise.
In my experiences being a firefighter for 33 years, I have never seen such complete devastation. There were numerous vehicles that were burned out, and the houses, there were no very few walls or anything standing above the ground.
Yeah.
Mobile homes were nothing but a metal frame.
And now it's, I mean, you're in this debris, which is also somewhat of a, I don't know, sacred place. This is a funeral pyre. I mean, there are people, remains that you're searching for. I know you have, you know, all the hazmat outfits on and everything, but how do you steel yourself for that?
I am, that's why I joined the search and rescue team as a volunteer. I wanted to help my community, my citizens, as best I could. Unfortunately, I've been called numerous times to fires. We had the Thomas Fire last year, mm-hmm. and a debris flow with 23 loss. And
right.
I was actually involved with a victim recovery with that as well. Mm-hmm. But I am rewarded and satisfied by being able to do it. But also, I don't want anybody else to have to see it.
Mm.
My firefighters that I used to work with, some of them are impacted significantly with post-traumatic stress of seeing this.
Mm.
And I have been allowed to do it knowing that I have done my best to bring closure to the families and friends of these victims. And when people ask me, including my family, why do I do it, I tell them, you know, it's actually my mission in life. It's my purpose. And I'm really comforted by the team members and giving them support because they have jobs. They're engineers, laborers.
I want to ask you about that. I'm sorry to interrupt, but first of all, thank you, you know, for your service. But we know that a law in California requires county sheriffs to maintain these volunteer search and rescue teams. I mean, your thoughts on that, that this is a largely volunteer group of people.
Well, it is just that. Amazing to see someone who's never been exposed, who's been in a somewhat of a protected environment, mm-hmm. working, you know, in an office, and now they're providing this service back to community. I think there's no greater love. I have seen a sign when they were thanking us after fires, and they said, there's no greater love. And, you know, I've kept that in my heart, mm-hmm. and explaining it to the new members that we have come on the team to see if they're prepared for it. No one is expected to see what we've seen unless they're in a war zone.
Well, and I want to ask you about that, and want to warn people that this may be very uncomfortable for listeners to hear, but it tells us about what you and these volunteers are doing. You found things.
Oh, yes.
Can you share?
In my mind, I had pictured what I've seen before in people being burned in fires, but this was just literally bone fragments, and the search dog that was assigned to my team, he found a skull underneath a trailer, and it was, you could obviously tell that was a person.
Well, and it also tells you, forensically, that it's a person who probably tried to hide under a trailer. And, you know, it's just heartbreaking. What happens in that moment?
Well, one of my team members actually said, you know, I'm okay with it, and we ask one another. There's a peer support system somewhat there. I've been on full body recoveries, and when you see the person's face or disfigurement from an accident, you know, you just have to say, you did all you can do and recover the mains.
Yeah.
You feel sad because it is tragic to lose a life.
But on the other hand, you are bringing closure to
exactly.
a family. Yeah.
And you know, a missing person is just that. And we still have two victims from the debris flow missing, a 2-year-old and a 17-year-old boy.
Oh.
And
this is in Santa Barbara.
This is in Montecito,
yeah.
correct.
Yeah, Montecito.
And I've been out. We continue to search with the dogs when the debris piles are moved or the significant probability that there's an odor or something coming from an area, and it could turn out to be nothing, but we'll continue to search till we find them.
That's from a year ago, and you're still doing it. I'm anticipating
yes.
this. There will be searching in Northern California for a long time to come. Chris Blair, again, retired firefighter from Santa Barbara, who was one of the hundreds of volunteers who took part in what's turning into one of the largest searches in California state history in Paradise. I'm wondering, too, are you worried now? You're talking about the debris slide, and that was because of the fire. Are you worried now with the rain coming of a slide in Paradise?
Oh, without a doubt. There was crews there preparing the area for. They were spray hydroseeding the hillsides. They were removing trees 50 feet or more around the roads so they don't fall across when the mud does flow. And it's the job of looking forensically for through the debris piles is going to be probably made impossible.
Chris Blair, thank you so much for your work. Thank you.
Thank you. And as I said, I'm just happy to be able to provide closure to these families. And I wouldn't want to have anybody else have to do it. If I was there, I could be able to do it.
Well, President Trump is standing by Saudi Arabia despite the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. In a written statement today, the president said it very well could be that the Saudi crown prince had knowledge of the killing, but that the United States intends to remain a steadfast partner of Saudi Arabia. NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie joins us now. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Jeremy.
So even though the evidence is pointing to the crown prince being aware of and maybe even ordering the killing of Khashoggi, Trump is saying the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia is the most important thing.
That's right. In recent days, the CIA assessment has been that most likely the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, did know about this, the killing last month of Khashoggi. But Trump's very lengthy statement really stresses the economic relationship, the Saudi purchase of U.S. weapons and other investments in the U.S., as well as the security relationship that the Saudis are very important to the U.S. in that region. And that, in effect, trumps any other issue at the moment, and the U.S. will remain a very solid ally of Saudi Arabia.
We were waiting to hear what the president thought of this, because there's obviously a risk in hurting the relationship with Saudi Arabia. There's also a risk in sending the message, if indeed it was the crown prince who ordered this killing, that it's okay to kill people who disagree with you in a government around the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the fundamental question is, can you do two separate things? Be an ally of Saudi Arabia, a very important country to the United States, but also be a critic of a friend and an ally when they do something like this killing. And the president criticized it, but is not gave no indication that he's going to take any additional action beyond the limited sanctions that have been imposed on some individuals, but not the crown prince.
Greg, another big story we're following today in Afghanistan, a suicide bomber attacked a gathering of Muslim religious scholars in Kabul. Officials say at least 40 people were killed, another 65 wounded. What more do we know about this attack?
Well, big attack, central Kabul. It's a national holiday there. It's celebrated as the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad. These big gatherings continue to be a target frequently. And Afghanistan just last week had 3 attacks of almost similar size on the security forces where 40 or more people were killed. This one's getting a lot of attention because it was right in the heart of Kabul, but it just drives home how dangerous and precarious life is still in Afghanistan.
And why would terrorists be targeting Muslim clerics?
Well, I think it's partly they want to show that the clerics that are aligned with the government are not really people they support. The Taliban or the Islamic State have their own view of how the country should be run. So it's partly going after clerics. It's partly going after big gatherings. It's partly waging an attack in the center of Kabul just to show how fragile the government is. Right. So I think all of those things are part of it.
And just a few seconds here. Greg, but President Trump has not visited Afghanistan as president. He's under pressure about that because he didn't go to Arlington Cemetery on Veterans Day. We're coming up on Thanksgiving. Do you think we're going to see a surprise trip from the president to a war zone?
I really don't know the answer to that, but the president has shown he did seem to take some sense that maybe he didn't do enough on Veterans Day. Maybe he hasn't expressed enough interest in these conflicts. So keep an eye out for that. We don't have any information on it at present.
That is NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
When President Trump tweeted last week without evidence that ballots in the Florida election were massively infected, many news outlets repeated his statement in headlines and tweets without pointing out that it was untrue. That bothered Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, who thinks the media should be doing more to stop spreading misinformation when it quotes the president. Derek joins us now from New York. Hi.
Hey, Jeremy.
So this issue is one that the media have been grappling with since Trump announced he was running for president. He's not the first president to say things that are not true, although in the month leading up to the midterms, the Toronto Star journalist Daniel Dale says Trump made an average of 26 false claims a day. What do you think the media ought to be doing?
This is a really hard issue because on the one hand, it is very clearly the media's job to report what the president of the United States says, thinks, and is about to do. Obviously, that's the case. But it's also obviously the case that the president passes along falsehoods and conspiracy theories and sometimes even hate speech. And therefore, I think the question for a lot of news outlets is, how do we quote the president without essentially acting as hosts for a viral lie or a viral conspiracy? And I come up with sort of two theories here, and mostly what I'm concerned with, because in a long article, maybe there can be a lot of context, I'm really concerned with headlines and tweets because so many people consume the media almost exclusively through reading the headline or just reading a tweet or short Facebook post. So I suggest, one, something like selective abstinence, that is not necessarily defaulting to quoting the president every single time he says a falsehood, but rather fronting that, or rather sticking with the truth and covering other things that are entirely true, or second, aggressive contextualization. The linguist George Lakoff has called this bracketing or sandwiching. That is, if the president says something that's untrue, like about the ballots, you lead with something that's true, the results of the Senate election, you put the president's statement in the middle, and then you close with the truth again that fact checks the president. That's hard work, but I think it's necessary work for journalism in the age of Trump.
So on this show, on Here and Now, we have this thing at the top of the show called The Billboard, and it's 1 minute long. And we sort of say this is what's coming up on the show. And oftentimes we have to put a clip of President Trump in the billboard. And we have actually taken them out at times. If it is something that's going to require too much fact checking afterwards, we'll just take it out. But that brings me to my next question. Is there a risk for the media in spending all of its time just fact checking every little thing that the president says?
Yeah, I think there is. I think there is absolutely a risk to dedicating a lot of time toward quoting the president and then trying to show with data ways that he's lying. Now, on the one hand, fact-checking seems to work for some news viewers. There was a study done by Brendan Nyhan, I think last year, that looked at fact-checking and found that indeed fact-checking does seem to work. It does seem to help people update their views toward the truth, but not all the time. In fact, sometimes sometimes, especially when audiences are older, less educated, and also it seems having a more conservative bent because conservatives tend to be more distrusting of the news media, they sometimes react to fact checks negatively by distrusting that media organization even more and, in fact, assuming, as one Gallup poll recently showed, that news organizations that try to fact check the president are themselves ipso facto fake news. Hmm. So this is a really complicated issue because it seems from this body of research like fact checking can work for one part of the American electorate, but for another part of the American electorate, it could actually turn them against the news media that's trying to pass along the truth in the first place.
Derek, in your piece about this week in The Atlantic, we'll link to it at hereandnow.org, you call Trump's lies a virus and the media the host that spreads the virus. Just briefly, what kind of response have you gotten?
Oh, man. What kind of response have I gotten? Well, look, let me tell you the truth. The truth is that I don't honestly write about the president that often. My day job, as it were, is to be an economic, culture, and media commentator. And I approach this article and this issue from the capacity of caring about the media's role passing along truth. When I wrote this piece, though, I got a little glimpse into the world of political journalism. And the tweets and the emails and the Facebook responses that I received were not nice. And I cannot, frankly, imagine what daily life is like for our colleagues who spend all day, all week, covering Trump. It is a virulent and vicious atmosphere out there.
Derek Thompson at The Atlantic, thank you and happy Thanksgiving. And speaking of Thanksgiving, here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, is here to talk about side dishes. And Kathy, everybody has their own way of doing it.
Definitely. It's all about rituals and traditions. And I honor that. We always do cream spinach.
Okay.
My dad's cream spinach. He's been gone for years, but there's no way I wouldn't have cream spinach on the table with freshly grated nutmeg. Amazing. And our stuffing, when my kids were little, it was always fresh New England oysters, celery, fresh herbs. And I would start collecting five or six different types of bread. And you want the bread not to be stale, but not to be soft. You want it to be kind of crunchy and just shy of stale. And that makes the best stuffing. But I never told my kids there was oysters in there.
I'm getting hungry already as you talk about this, Kathy, and thinking to myself that I'm about to have like a half of a Thanksgiving just a couple days before
sitting
I have a real Thanksgiving.
Exactly.
But let's talk about what you've got right in front of us here, some side dishes, roasted vegetables.
Roasted vegetables, which is that probably a lot of people are thinking, that's what she's doing? I do that all the time. But the roast vegetable platter, first of all, is so stunning with all the colors of this season. Mm-hmm. There's sweet potatoes, there's winter squash, there's garlic, there's red onion, white onion, baby turnips.
These peppers are incredible.
Aren't
too.
The peppers great? And what I do is I cut everything into equal size pieces. I put them in a huge sheet pan, olive oil, salt, and pepper. Still, it sounds kind of basic. But once all the vegetables are tender, I make a vinaigrette with fresh pomegranate seeds and pomegranate juice. And that gives it this gorgeous color, a lot of vitamin C, a lot of flavor.
In the vinaigrette, like in addition to the vinegar and what else?
So it's just oil, vinegar, salt, pepper, pomegranate seeds, and then I squeeze the pomegranate and get all the fresh juice out. So you can see the pomegranate vinaigrette is a beautiful, rich, dark color. And then I sprinkle fresh pomegranate seeds over the whole thing. And this is the dish when you have a vegetarian coming to Thanksgiving that really is a main course. When you see all these roasted vegetables on a platter in the middle of your table, you're going to be like, I don't care
that I'm not having any turkey.
Yep. Well, right. I love turkey once or twice a year.
I'm just thinking in the mind of a vegetarian looking
yes,
at that.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. They must be very happy.
So really, it's roast vegetables, so it's not super hard. You're not rethinking everything, but the pomegranate, you know what it's the equivalent to? If you wore black pants to your holiday meal, but you put on a sparkly gold top.
One does want a hint of color.
Exactly.
What about this squash that you've got here?
I am in love with this. So this is a butternut squash from our garden. I peeled it. I seeded it. I cut it into half-inch slice pieces. And this is what you call a gratin, which is a French dish.
Mm-hmm.
And I put it into layers in a nice roasting dish, sprinkled it with some tiny, tiny bit of flour. You don't need that, actually. Maple syrup. And I roasted it with some milk and heavy cream until the heavy cream and the milk just get thick and gooey. And
I've never had that with squash before, a gratin with squash.
Yeah, you usually have it with leeks or different vegetables. But I felt that it needed something else. And I'm always trying to emphasize texture. So I took some pistachio nuts, salted pistachios, which I adore, and I toasted them. And I chopped them up very coarsely with some panko breadcrumbs. And I sprinkled the pistachio and panko over the squash gratin. And I'm just loving that.
Are these dishes that you can cook beforehand? Because obviously the turkey on Thanksgiving Day takes up a lot of time.
You could roast these vegetables and the squash the night ahead of time or in the morning while you're prepping your turkey. Also, you have to remember, you take your turkey out at least 30 to 40 minutes before you serve it because you want it to sit before you carve it. So you could throw the vegetables in and reheat them then. I also wanted to say, Jeremy, we were talking about ritual before and tradition. Don't get rid of all your old recipes. Introduce one or two new recipes at Thanksgiving just to keep it fresh. But, you know, you need to be saying to your family, I understand, you expect that Jell-O mold.
I have never, ever had a Thanksgiving with a Jell-O mold, as far as I can remember.
Lucky
but
you.
But when I think of that, all I think of is Aunt Bethany in Christmas Vacation. With
Well, my mother-in-law, who was a phenomenal cook, made Aunt Polly's Jell-O mold, and it had crushed pineapple, orange sherbet, and Jell-O. And we all hated it and we moaned and groaned. And now she is also gone. And we're like, let's make Granny's Jell-O mold.
Kathy, I had such a good taste in my mouth after these delicious vegetables that you made. And now you're making me think of a Jell-O mold with, oh my gosh.
There is the melancholy.
Okay, let's get back to what we're talking about here. Side dishes. Okay.
And is that what we were talking
yes,
about?
Yes, that is what we were talking about. And that's what we were eating. And they are really good. And I encourage people to go to hearnow.org and check out the recipes.
Can I mention one other dish?
Yes, please.
The other dish that I think is severely neglected on the Thanksgiving table is salad. Every year I make a big salad. Yeah. Arugula, radicchio, endive. Maybe I'll throw some toasted nuts in or persimmons or orange slices. And everyone's like, I can't.
No, it's a palate cleanser.
Exactly.
Gets you ready for the pie.
That's right. You do it French style. You have it after the meal and you think you can't eat another bite because you just want dessert. Try a beautiful winter salad.
Okay. You've got us all hungry for Thanksgiving. And by the way, people can check out my sister's recipe for a green chili mac and cheese.
Yum.
Also at hearandnow.org. Kathy, thanks as always. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Two recreational marijuana shops open for business today in Massachusetts, nearly 2 years after voters approved a ballot question legalizing recreational use of the drug in the state. And the Northampton and Leicester shops became the first on the East Coast to legally sell recreational marijuana. Here's Lynn Blair in Leicester. She waited in line for 90 minutes with her cousins before getting inside.
Yeah, I always felt like such a criminal for trying to get it, you know, from somebody else or grow it on your own. So now I think the freedom of being able to, you know, be who you are and use what you want. And, you know, as long as you're in the safety of your own home, I see nothing wrong with that.
Well, WBUR reporter Allie Jarmanning is also in Leicester. That's in the middle of the state, Northampton out in the west near New York State. And Allie, it seems people found their way there. Shops open at 8 a.m. What was it like?
So, yeah, the people actually started lining up at 7. That's when security let them finally kind of line up at the doors. And people were just giddy to be able to get into there and have their first taste of legal recreational marijuana sales. It was a lot of people who just wanted a little piece of history.
Well, you're in Leicester. That includes over in Northampton, the mayor of Northampton, David Narkowitz, who was the first person in line, and he wanted to be the first to legally purchase cannabis east of the Mississippi River. And he said he's going to keep it for posterity, for the town's history. But what do people have to have? I mean, we know Cultivate and New England Treatment Access, or NETA, are the two dispensaries. When you go in, What do you have to have?
Yeah, so you have to have your license or some kind of government-issued ID that's showing that you're over 21, and today you needed cash. There's a couple people who did not have cash and walked away kind of disappointed that they couldn't buy anything today. But other than that, you can walk out just like you would walk out with, you know, a six-pack of beer or a bottle of liquor or anything like that.
Well, the difference, of course, it has to be cash because banking is under federal regulations, and right now this is against the federal law.
Yeah, so there are some places that take debit cards with a fee. Cultivate here wasn't taking them till about noon today for some reason. But yeah, you cannot use a credit card like you would for any kind of other purchase.
Right. Also, what are some of the other restrictions? How much can you buy? Can you just walk outside and eat it or smoke it?
So there are a couple things you can't do. You can't use it in a public place, and that would include your car. So people who drove here have to wait till they get into the comfort of their own home to light up or eat or vape or whatever it is that they were planning on doing with their marijuana. And they can only buy legally an ounce or less of flower at a time. And then actually Netta out in Western Mass is limiting that to a quarter ounce today because of the issues with supply and making sure that they have enough to go around today.
Right. Look, there are people who are opposed to this. Are they there as well?
You know, I don't know if there's anybody who is outright opposed to it. It's interesting in the town of Leicester. They've had a medical marijuana facility, Cultivate, here for a couple years. They're going to have some other kind of facilities here. And they're a community that really has embraced this. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of these towns really do see the benefit of having jobs, of having tax revenue that's going to come to them. They get to add a little bit of tax revenue on that part of that 20% on recreational sales. So I think they really see the benefit of having someplace like this.
And by the way, what's the age limit?
You have to be 21 or older.
Okay. WBUR's reporter Ali Jarmining in Leicester, Massachusetts, becoming one of the first shops east of the Mississippi here on the East Coast to legally sell recreational marijuana. Ali, thank you.
Thank you.
In Texas, Democrats did not win big in the midterms in statewide offices, but they did score wins in some other areas, including in Dallas County, where the incumbent Republican District Attorney Faith Johnson was easily knocked off by Democrat John Cruzo. He's a former judge, prosecutor, and defense attorney. He joins us now. Judge Cruzo, thank you for joining us and congratulations.
Thank you.
So you have not yet been sworn in as DA, and you're already making headlines about your take on the case of Botham Jean, who is the black man shot and killed in his apartment by a white off-duty police officer, Amber Geiger. This happened in September. Police brought a manslaughter charge against her, but there's been a lot of public criticism about that decision, including from you. You think she should have been charged with murder. Why?
Well, so one of the problems with this case is, what do the facts support as far as a charge? And in the state of Texas, manslaughter is when you've acted recklessly, and murder is when you've either acted intentionally or knowingly to cause the death of an individual, or you committed an act that was clearly dangerous to human life that caused the death of the other person. And there's nothing from what has been reported about the facts of this case, in my mind, that support a manslaughter charge. And all of the facts support a murder charge. And that's all I've said. I have seen no reports, no anything other than what's been reported in a newspaper or on television. So I don't know all the facts. But based on what I have seen, the more appropriate charge is murder, not manslaughter.
We spoke with the outgoing district attorney, Faith Johnson, shortly after the shooting and asked her about the manslaughter charge. Here's what she told us.
That's what you need to ask the Texas Rangers. They came out without arrest. You got to remember, we had nothing to do with the charges or the arrest because we're not the arresting agency. We are the prosecution.
What do you make of that answer?
Well, I think probably someone should have followed up and said, what's your personal opinion? No one ever did that. And I think what she was saying to everyone, in addition to that, was that she had a spirited, I think was the word she used, discussion with them about the propriety of the charge. And then said that that was a confidential discussion. But once again, nobody asked her what was her personal opinion about it. And so what I wrote about was my personal opinion based on the facts as I understood them to be, and that it should be murder. So I don't know what her personal opinion is. Mm-hmm. I think that the case will go to the grand jury. That's my understanding, before the end of the year. And I am assuming that it will be taken as a murder charge.
Well, and actually, she has said that she wants to stay on the Botham Jean case because it happened under her watch. Is that something you would consider?
Well, I can't stop her from doing it. And that's okay with me. I trust that she's going to go forward in the appropriate manner on it.
What do you think that that case says about police and African-Americans in Texas and in this country today?
Well, I think let's just take that particular case out, because that case actually has some problems from the prosecutor's side. But obviously, the use of force and deadly force and encounters with African-Americans, mostly men and poor people, people of color in this country, is beyond what is necessary. And sometimes it's just straight murder or some other criminal act by a police officer. I don't think that most of our police officers do that, but obviously some. It says something about our culture and where we are today in race relations and in treatment of different communities by the police. But I think that, you know, this particular case does have some very strong defensive issues, and I've written about that. When I wrote about the difference between murder and manslaughter, I included the potential problems that the prosecution will have with the case based on the facts, once again, as I understand them. Number one, mistake of fact. If she was truly mistaken as to which apartment she was in, and if she gets the benefit of that, then she may get the benefit of self-defense and defense of property at night. In Texas, there are certain circumstances where you can defend property with deadly force, but only at night. And so those are kind of unique things to the state of Texas, and she may have the benefit of those, and it could affect the outcome of the case.
You retired from the bench in 2012, but before that, you got a lot of national attention for your diversion drug court. Instead of jailing first-time offenders, you would first look at whether rehab was the best option. And throughout your campaign, you promised real justice reform. What does that look like to you, especially in the context of what's happening in Washington and that they may be looking at criminal justice reform at the federal level as well right now?
Well, criminal justice reform means to me dealing with structural mass incarceration. And that doesn't have any – it's not just about misdemeanor offenses. You know, I have promised that we're not going to file, certainly on first-time offenders, under 4 ounces of marijuana cases. And even if we do deal with a subsequent case, it'll be as a public health problem as opposed to a criminal justice issue. But when you talk about criminal justice reform, that means different things to different people. Those are very limited proposals coming from the Trump administration. I'm talking about doing something different and far more far-reaching than what he's talking about. We're talking about looking at lower-degree felonies and treating them as a public health issue as opposed to a criminal justice issue when appropriate.
Like what kind of
the
felonies?
The other thing that's, well, drug cases and prescription fraud cases. We have a program right now that I started, for example, that deals with the two lowest level felony offenses, where if you finish the program, the case is dismissed and it's expunged. But if there's no capacity for you to get into the program, for example, it's full, or if you don't need clinical intervention and you're not appropriate for the program, then you're prosecuted and you wind up with a criminal record. And I don't think that's fair. That's not balanced. And if we're going to let the folks who have the worst problems come out and get a case dismissed and expunged, then we ought to make that same process available. Maybe not exactly that they go through a diversion program, but they have an opportunity to come up out the back end with their case dismissed and expunged also.
And what would you say if somebody like President Trump were to look at that kind of a proposal and say, that's weak on crime, we want to be tough on crime?
It came from his mouth. I wouldn't pay much attention to it at all, to be quite honest. But on the other hand, when polled, Republicans, people who identify themselves as Republicans, when polled on this issue and this approach, the approval of it is over 70%. And, of course, people who identify themselves as Democrats, the approval rating is much higher. So it's really a bipartisan issue. Our legislature has increasingly put in laws that fund treatment and fund diversion, and we've put in more money to train judges and to incentivize communities, our counties, to have these programs, and that started under Rick Perry. So it is a bipartisan issue as far as the legislature is concerned, because in adopting these types of policies, we have closed 8 prisons when we were projected to need 17,000 additional prison beds. So we've gone from 150,000 prisoners to 141, mm-hmm. instead of going from 150,000 to 167,000. So it's been quite a savings to the state, and crime hasn't gone up. We've actually reduced crime by dealing with and addressing the underlying issues for criminal behavior.
What are you most excited about with your new role coming up?
Oh, I think the opportunity to realign the office where things are more effective and that we focus on crime reduction and cost reduction and addressing structural mass incarceration. I think that's a big challenge. And then adopting new policies and new procedures and then looking at the outcomes to make certain that we're achieving our goals. I'm excited about that.
That is John Creuzot, who is the district attorney-elect for Dallas County. He is a Democrat who beat the incumbent Republican, and he takes office in January. Judge Creuzot, thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you.
And as you've probably heard, President Trump has been extolling the virtues of Finnish forest care while blaming California's mismanagement for the massive wildfires still burning there. Here he is in fire-ravaged Butte County last weekend.
You look at other countries where they do it differently, and it's a whole different story. I was with the president of Finland, and he said, we have a much different, we're a forest nation. He called it a forest nation. And they spend a lot of time on raking and cleaning and doing things, and they don't have any problem. And when it is, it's a very small problem.
Well, the president of Finland says he did talk recently with President Trump about his country's forests, but he never mentioned raking, which now has its own hashtag, haravointi. I believe that's raking in Finnish. There's also Rake America Great Again, pictures posted of Finns with rakes, one Finnish woman vacuuming an entire forest floor. And here's a video posted by Finnish TV host Aleksi Valavori.
Like President Trump said, we Finns, we spend a lot of time on raking, cleaning and doing things. That's how we prevent wildfires. It doesn't have to do anything with our climate. No. We have to rake. It's mandatory in Finland. We have to rake 2 hours per day. We even have raking universities in Finland. That's how we learn to rake.
Ha ha. But what is true about Finnish forest management? Let's bring in Pasi Putinen. He's head of the Department of Forest Sciences at the University of Helsinki. Professor Putinen, when you heard the president's comments, what did you think?
We were surprised because it didn't have anything to do with real forest science and forest. But on the other hand, we are used to Mr. Trump's opinions that are wide and large.
But what is true about Finnish forest management? What do the Finns do?
I think that the big difference between the Western U.S. And Finland is that we do thinnings in the forest stands. So while the forest age, we take the material that would otherwise die, we take it away. So thinnings are part of the Nordic forest management.
So you do some thinnings. We also understand that you have an early warning system, aerial surveillance systems. You have local aviation clubs paid to fly over areas of forest so they can spot something early on?
Yes, and that's becoming more important as the climate is changing here as well. Like the past summer was one of the record warm summers, and the government invested more for this voluntary surveillance flights.
You mentioned warm summers. The other thing that people are rushing to point out is that Finland is much colder than California.
Yes, that's true. Although we are close to the Arctic Circle, that Gulf Stream keeps the whole Finnoscandia, Norway, Sweden and Finland reasonably warm. And in winter temperatures here in Helsinki, we rarely get anything below minus 15 or minus 10 in the months of January, February. So, yeah, cold compared to California, yeah.
Yeah, cold compared to California. And wetter, you have rain. California's been in droughts. So some people have said the comparison just doesn't work. Look, President Trump has his supporters here for his comments. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke said in an interview with Breitbart News that these forest fires are the fault of environmental radicals. He was backed by a forester named Joe Denham. He said the problems that cause fires include, you know, environmentalists preventing access roads from being built, that it was logging that's needed to thin the forest as it used to do, to which other forestry people have responded that some of our recent fires here were along the coast on private land with few trees. Access was not a problem. And that there hasn't been enough rain. That is something that most scientists here agree on. It's hotter and drier, leading to longer and more intense wildfire seasons.
It seems that that's happening here as well. And here in the Nordic countries, but of course the worst is in southern Europe throughout the Mediterranean region, which as the climate is the same as in California. So the fire season is definitely much, much longer.
Look, some misinformation got out about Finn's raking.
Yes.
But I'm wondering, as a climate scientist or a forest scientist, you might be grateful that, at least, you know, the conversation is being had.
I think it's there are misunderstandings easily amongst countries or between countries about how management is done and so on. And this case, I think, it's a good example of a sort of a misunderstanding. But on the other hand, it has caused for us Finns caused good sort of a source of laugh, and the headlines here are quite amusing.
Even if the subject is pretty serious.
Even if, yeah.
Yeah. I'm Professor Putinen, head of the Department of Forest Sciences at the University of Helsinki. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you for having me in the air.
Okay. So people in Finland do not rake to prevent forest fires. We'll link you to some of the pictures of Finns having fun with the thought at herenow.org. But Californians know they have to rake up eucalyptus branches and other combustible debris. So what is true about California forest management? Next week, we're planning an in-depth look at that and the role of climate change. You can start the conversation right now at hereandnow.org with this story. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Hope you're enjoying the drive to Thanksgiving already on this Tuesday. It's Here and Now.